Hello, everyone, and welcome to the YJBM Science News Podcast, where we discuss the most recent science news from across the Yale community. I'm Sam, first-year MPH student in the Department of Health Policy.
And I am Mara, a second-year PhD student in microbiology. So, welcome back, everyone. We're back from the spring break. Some of us had a very interesting one. Some of us, I'm not going to name who, stayed here and did a lot of lab work. But regardless, there is some really interesting research be going on in the meantime. And we also have a couple announcements. Yep. First of all, as you probably heard, Peabody Museum is open back. I'm super excited. Sam, how about you?
I am very excited. Every time I walk by it and I see the giant dinosaur sculpture in front of it, I just know that the inside of the museum is going to be great, and I love dinosaurs. So I'm so excited. I already have a time slot with one of my good friends to go in and check it out. So I cannot wait.
Yeah, so you guys also have to treat yourself sometime soon.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's get moving. Mara, what do you have for us today?
Well, first article that caught my attention is this one that was just published in Nature Methods. And this research is actually a part of a 20-year-long project known as Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, or ENCODE, funded by National Human Genome Research Institute. So this is actually a collaborative study between Stanford, Yale, and it's led by the Yale School of Medicine's Dr. Stephen Riley. And what they're doing is they're looking into the non-coding DNA regions.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit more about the structure of the human genome?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I already mentioned, there are protein coding regions and non-coding regions. Now, protein coding is the ones that you usually think about in terms of genes, right? Some kind of sequence of DNA then gets translated into mRNA that gets then translated into the protein. And proteins are building blocks of everything. Proteins do all the functions in the cells, pretty much. But this is only a very, very small portion of the whole genome that's encoded in different chromosomes. Now, the rest of it is what we call non-coding regions. And they are usually types of accessory regions. So some of them may be somehow helping the protein coding regions by attracting the machinery to transcribe them, or maybe upregulating and downregulating the expression. And really, the pattern of expression is what makes up the cell, because, you know, all cells have exactly the same DNA. However, they look very different, right? There's a difference between a neuron and a skin cell. That's because they express different regions. And as you can understand, because of that, non-coding regions are very, very important.
Wait, that's a great explanation. So what did the researchers focus on?
Well, they focused on two specific types of non-coding DNA regions. First of all, they focused on promoters, which are usually located upstream of a coding, protein coding region. And what they do is they attract the machinery, which will then go on to the gene and make it into an mRNA. And important is that promoters can also be upregulated or downregulated. For example, you may have something sitting on top of a promoter preventing the machinery binding to it and proceeding with the transcription. Another thing that they focused on is called enhancers, which are also a type of regulatory sequence which in its own way can enhance or downregulate the expression, usually enhancing. But they are not as directly linked to the gene that they can be enhancing. Right, they can be quite far away if we think about DNA as like a strand of different letters. They can be pretty, pretty far away down the text. So that just makes it really hard to identify and link to different genes. And this can also result in making it hard to link to different mutations and diseases that can result from it.
How did they proceed with the task then?
Well, first of all, the task that they had was to map those different promoters and enhancers, because if you imagine the whole text, the books and books of human genome, it's hard to find. Now, there are some ways that promoters and enhancers can be identified by maybe like some specific sequences that are more likely to be present in promoters and enhancers. So first of all, what they had to do, they had to find all of it. And I assume that's more bioinformatics heavy task. Now, after that, they want to see, okay, here are regions that might be a promoter or enhancer. What genes are they linked to, and how do they impact the expression of that gene? So they used a method called CRISPR interference. And you probably heard about CRISPR, right? So like molecular scissors that you can direct towards a separate part of the gene or DNA sequence. Now, CRISPR interference doesn't just cut things out, but instead it silences it. So the DNA composition of the cell is not changed, but instead you see a lower level of whatever it's targeting. So they use this mechanism to silence like big chunks of DNA, not just small parts. And just to give you an idea, they performed these experiments on more than 540,000 sections of DNA.
Oh my gosh.
So this has only been possible because it was a very large-scale collaboration between major labs. And it's really, really interesting to me just like how much of it goes into collaborative efforts and so many people working on those experiments. Because those are not like findings-directed experiments. Those are like exploratory ones. But the findings and most importantly the methods that they developed for using this kind of screens will be used by researchers in the future. And since we're talking about applications, right? First of all, they can find how different mutations in those regions can be linked to diseases. And as I said already, non-coding regions are the majority of DNA. So that means that most mutations that are going to be occurring are going to be occurring in those regions. So linking those to genes that may not even have a mutation is very important to identifying the cause and how we can fix this certain genetic disease. And then something they also mentioned that I found interesting is that it have impact on personalized medicine. So a certain approach can be used in specific cells that belong to a patient, to an individual patient, to see how mutations can be corrected. And just one last thing that I wanted to mention is that they found this really interesting thing, is that enhancers can actually control multiple genes. It's not just one enhancer per gene, but actually one enhancer can control multitude of them, which just really highlights our understanding of non-coding regions as separated into those little accessory regions has been in place for a while. But there's still so much we do not know about it, even the most basic things, that I'm just really excited to see what else they can dig up in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. No, this was really interesting. I'm particularly excited for the personalized medicine application just because I feel as though personalized medicine really is the next, you know, frontier, big thing. And I do think that, you know, one-size-fits-all medicine kind of really leaves people falling through the cracks and not getting the treatment that they need and the most effective one. So I'm excited to see how this goes.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's especially applicable in terms of, for example, cancers, because cancers are really not made equal. They're all different diseases in its essence. And finding exact mutations causing them is definitely going to be the future for anti-cancer treatment.
Yeah.
All right, with that, okay, Sam, tell us about the next study that we have.
So this next study comes to us from researchers at Yale School of Medicine, and it was published in Cell Metabolism on the 22nd. It looks at the effects of pregnancy on aging, which is interesting to me because, as we know, stress can accelerate the body's aging process, and pregnancy is a process that can be very stressful for pregnant people. So it would not surprise me personally if it also caused a significant amount of stress on the body and accelerated aging.
So how did they conduct the study and what did they find?
Well, essentially what the researchers in the study sought to do is to replicate and extend the findings of a previous study by Paganic and colleagues that really found that pregnancy, among other physiological stressors, is connected to an acceleration of aging in mice with a partial reversal of this post-pregnancy. And they also found that this association beyond mice also occurs in humans. So in order to replicate these findings, the researchers conducted a prospective longitudinal low-risk pregnancy cohort at the University of California, Irvine Development, Health, and Disease Research Program. And they looked at longitudinal DNA data from blood samples given by 119 women across stages of pregnancy as well as post-pregnancy. And these samples were then used to generate estimates of biological aging in the women. Hierarchical generalized additive models were then used to examine the association between the stage of pregnancy and the speed of biological aging, as well as, you know, when or if a reversal of this aging process would occur. So they used the models at which were adjusted for factors such as maternal age, parity, race and ethnicity, education, household income, and technical factors related to DNA profiling. And what they found after completing their examinations was a significant positive association between the stage of pregnancy and biological age, as well as a statistically significant reversal of biological aging from late pregnancy to around 3 months postpartum. However, these trends were found to be influenced by maternal pre-pregnancy BMI and whether a mother exclusively breastfed. But it was not influenced or predicted by maternal gestational weight gain. So essentially, what this study was able to do was it replicated the results of the initial study, that it was successful.
Nice. No, that's good to know. Replicability, as everybody knows, is the basis of scientific experimentation. So happy to know that this is legit.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, happy to know it's legit. Sad to know that pregnancy accelerates aging. But the reversal thing is something that you didn't know about.
Yeah, I definitely expected that pregnancy will accelerate aging all mm-hmm. the way, just because of mm-hmm. the amount of stress that's put on the body, and we do know that's not exactly good if you want to keep your youth. But, yeah, the more you know.
Yeah, especially the reversal 3 months postpartum. I feel like you hear so much about the newborn stage and you know, babies being needy. And so I'm just like, whoa, okay. Anyway, moving on. What is your next study about?
Well, the next study is led by Dr. Joel Butterwig in Department of Pharmacology, and it was just published in Nature. What they focused on is discovering the molecular basis of insect sugar recognition.
Can you give us a little background on this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as we all know, animals need sugar, right? Not only they need sugar, but they love sugar. And I really think that's because of how essential sugar is for organisms for energy storage, energy generation, pretty much everything. And probably that's why nature was so nice and made sugar just so pleasant to eat. However, apparently insects have different receptors for different types of sugars. I really imagine it's like we have different receptors for, let's say, you know, something sweet and something bitter and something salty. They will be able to distinguish different sugars like that, which is just fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And what we really need to know here is that not all sugars are made equal. So some of them will have more energy in them. Some of them will be better for storage. Some they will require different enzymes to be broken down. There's just a lot of diversity in there. And insects are much better at discriminating between them. And the research really just wanted to look into mechanisms of this on a molecular level.
How did they conduct the research?
So for this study, they looked into an organism called Bombyx mori, which is just silkworm, really. And they focused on one receptor, GR9. And GR9 normally responds to one single sugar, D-fructose. Now, there are some sugars out there that are very, very similar in structure to D-fructose, which will actually bind to this receptor in the silkworm. However, it will not result in receptor activating. So they wanted to see how does this happen on molecular level. To do that, they figured out the structure of GR9 receptor, and also they looked at the structure with its normal ligand, D-fructose, bound and unbound to it. And they saw that it does have conformational change-inducing activity towards the receptor. However, other sugars, for example, they did those experiments with L-sorbose, which, as I said, very, very similar in structure, does have different activity with the receptor as compared to normal D-fructose. And when L-sorbose binds to the receptor, binds into this pocket where all the reaction happens, even though it can stick in there, it does not have the same activity chemically as D-fructose does. So it doesn't activate the same reaction, and receptor doesn't change conformation in the same way. So it's really interesting how not only the affinity of ligand plays a role here, but also very intricate details of its chemical structure and its ability to indicate this change.
What are some potential implications of this research?
You're right, because you're thinking, oh, there's an insect and it's like distinguishes sugar as cool, but what can we do about it? Why is it published in Nature? Well, first of all, yes, it's going to be really important for our future studies in like scent and taste recognition, because we're only just starting to discover how exactly this very essential process is happening. And another avenue here is the pharmacological implication of the study, because, well, this provides another view on how can a small molecule interact with a receptor, with a protein, which just gives a lot of opportunities for drug discovery. And then the third one, which is my personal favorite, is, okay, let's go back to why we're studying insects here. An insect of very big importance for public health is a mosquito. Now, mosquitoes also, they feed on nectar, they love sugar, and there's potential for this kind of research to be implicated in mosquito control, because maybe we can make mosquitoes that don't bite on specific substances. They're not attracted to human skin, to blood. So there's a lot of research that can be done on this avenue.
Awesome. That's actually so interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So let's finish this off. Sam, what is your study about?
It's so interesting that in the beginning we talked about how not every treatment works for everyone, and that's, you know, really a huge benefit of personalized treatment, because this next study is about why some people experience asthma symptoms despite receiving treatment. And the study comes to us from Yale School of Medicine. It aims to discover why certain individuals on eosinophil-directed treatments continue to display asthma symptoms. And the researchers did this by conducting a 53-study subject sub-study of a larger clinical trial that was investigating the effect of mepolizumab in reducing exacerbations of asthma and blood and airway eosinophils in urban children who have severe eosinophilic asthma.
And what did the study find?
So, from the 53 study subjects, the researchers obtained sputum samples, airway eosinophils were identified, and differences in frequency and according to the study, immunophenotype of sputum eosinophil subpopulations were assessed based on treatment arm and frequency of exacerbations. The study found that two of three subpopulations of eosinophils with varied expression of CD62L identified were more abundant in participants who experienced exacerbations than those who did not, meaning that children who received mepolizumab treatment but still experienced asthma symptoms were likely experiencing this due to those identified eosinophil subpopulations that they found in the study.
Interesting. I remember we had a study a little while back about, I think it was some kind of mu cells, could have been macrophages, like macrophage subpopulations with specific markers that also highlight individualized responses to treatment and disease. And it really plays into the same model of immunity.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And I think the more we look into, you know, within clinical trials, looking at who really is not being affected by the treatment, the closer we get to personalized medicine, at least from a different angle, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, this is all we have for today. Thank you for being with us this week. And so we will be back next week, but the week after that, I will be traveling.
Ooh,
I finally have my
going?
2 weeks off. I'm going to Europe.
Ooh.
I don't plan on reading any science news during that time. However, I'll be back with more inspiration, as per usual.
You'll be so motivated, so refreshed, and I will be not. But always interested in science news.
Wonderful. Yes. I hope to see the same attitude.
This was Mara and Sam with the YJBM Science News. See you next week. Bye.